Welcome to another episode of Daughters of Mormonism. We'll now continue with part two of Jenny A's interview.
My grandfather, the strict Catholic grandfather, he said, well, you're not going to go to graduate school now. You're going to quit school, right? You're pregnant. I said, no, I'm not. The baby's still inside. I have a year, basically, before I have to deal with school and a baby. So I'm going to Hawaii. I'm going to start graduate school. And while I was there, it was a little bit up in the air. Like, what am I doing here? I'm a Mormon woman having a baby. I'm married and I'm going to graduate school. How is this going to work? And so it obviously became a subject of much prayer. And I kept getting these answers like, you're where you're supposed to be. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. Stay. It'll work out. Just don't worry. And it didn't make sense to me at all. But I kept going. And one of my professors at one point said, we're not going to let you quit, just so you know. You'll be able to work it out. So come back next year. We know you'll have a 4-month-old, but it'll be okay. I'm like, okay, I'm trusting you. We'll see how this goes. And it actually turns out that I really, really needed graduate school to survive the transition to motherhood. I was so happy to have an outlet for my cerebralness. It's a theme. I've just been a very in my head kind of person since I learned how to think. And having such a physical experience of motherhood and early newborn months, I had to have a place for my head to go. At that point, I was bored with religion. I was bored with correlation, basically. And I had hit a brick wall, I felt like, in learning more about Mormon religion. And so that wasn't an avenue I felt like I could pursue. And I hadn't yet gotten the gumption, I guess, to expand beyond correlation. I was really intimidated by, I don't know, like the recent General Conference stuff about, you know, read your scriptures every day and the, you know, approved spiritual sources are prayer, scriptures, and the words of the prophets, period. You can't go beyond there. And I'm like, they all say the same thing. I've read them multiple times now. I'm done. Like, I'm burnt out on this information. It doesn't mean anything to me anymore. You know, I have this basic understanding of everything. I don't need to hear it 1,000 times again. Please stop. And I felt stuck. I was like, well, what do I do with my time now that I have to, like, I can breastfeed and I can diaper and I can take naps and I can take walks. I can do all of those things and care for my child. But what do I do with my head while I do those things? And graduate school offered that place for my head to go. I was reading textbooks while holding a baby. And at the same time, my husband was in his first year of graduate school. And so when I wasn't holding the baby, he was holding the baby and reading textbooks. And I love some of the pictures we have from that time because that was kind of our life. It was school and our baby and our family. And it was actually a very, very happy time for us. And to further complicate my transition to motherhood, I was really struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I thought that I was going to be free from mental illness after I joined the church. I was done with it. I hated the years that it afflicted my life. But because I knew that postpartum depression was probably a strong likelihood for me, I was very concerned that I was going to be experiencing that. Like, of course, right? I had had other periods of depression, and they always seemed to be linked to periods of change and transition, that it was, I obviously have a hard time dealing with big life changes, like losing a father, that I just felt like, obviously, hormones and birth and all of that, I'm going to have postpartum depression. And so when I was dealing with mental health kind of concerns, I knew what depression felt like. And I knew that's not what I was feeling. It was something different, but I didn't know what it was. And the reason how that came about was because my son's birth was very traumatic. And I credit his birth for what made me a feminist, for really what made me say, I'm not going to try to fly under the radar anymore when it comes to culture. I'm not going to just, so I consider my son's birth the catalyst for a crisis of culture, not a crisis of faith. And this really explains how I am who I am today. And for those who know me, I didn't lose faith in Mormon beliefs. I encountered a lot of things that I struggled with, yes, but it really almost always centered on culture and people and how people struggled with incorporating the principles of the church and living them rightly. So, and I don't know, I don't need to go into details about Willem's birth.
Do you want to give us just a basic idea?
Yeah. What ended up happening is that I didn't give much thought to maternity care. I kind of just did what the people around me were doing. And so that was hospital birth, because 98% of babies are born in hospitals. So of course I'm going to go there, right? Which is fine. But I knew from an experience that I had at 13 years old that I really wanted to have a natural birth. I watched A Baby Story, and I saw a hypnobirth where a woman was completely calm and completely like focused on birthing her baby. And there was no screaming and there was no emergency and there was no drama. It was just, it looked so normal to me. Add that to the religious conviction of we are created by heavenly parents and our bodies are amazing. And I was married to a biologist, and so I valued evolution, that like our bodies were made to give birth. And my body was made to do it without drugs, and I don't feel the need for drugs. I really don't think it could be that bad, so I'm going to have a natural birth. So that seems like that wouldn't be a big deal, right? Women have been giving birth naturally for thousands of years, and it still happens. I didn't realize, though, that the national epidural rate is like 80%, and that the C-section rate is like 1 in 3, and the induction rate is almost 50%, like it's 40%. I had no idea that I was back into bucking the system and being different just because I felt strongly about something. It had been a while since I had been in that place. And being where I was in my culture and not really sure how conforming I was going to be, it was really challenging to deal with some of the backlash that I experienced from wanting a natural birth. The only person I had support from was my mother and my husband and a couple of friends. I ended up having, this is funny, my ex-boyfriend, the one who named me Belle, who nicknamed me, his sister ended up being my doula. and so I was introduced to doulas through her. And I had no idea that I would go into the hospital and feel like every step of the way my desire for a natural birth was going to be undermined. Just the details of his story made it such that I could tell that my midwives had an agenda, and that agenda was an induction. And that induction, I was not going to consent to Pitocin and not get an epidural. And so whatever I felt about birth being natural and birth being a process designed by God and having blessings telling me that that was true really just put me in a rock and a hard place. It was like, I know what's right, and I know what's right for me, and you're telling me. It's that kind of authority thing. Like, here we are in a position where the people in authority are telling me that I should do one thing, but I feel like my higher authority is telling me something different. And that was difficult to deal with in the moment, especially of 17 hours of back labor and being in labor for over a day already and not having had sleep in 2 days. Really good combination. And so I ended up feeling like I was fighting them and running away, and that they were trying to force me into things that I was afraid of. And later I recognized that those experiences met the definition of a traumatic event, where I felt a sense of horror, helplessness, and fear for my life or the life of a loved one. I felt like I was protecting my baby from the risks of these interventions that I really wanted to avoid. And I felt like I was trying to protect my own body from violation against my will. So PTSD, it was not fun. And I spent months and months trying to figure out what was going on and why I had these flashbacks to his birth, and why I couldn't stop talking about it or thinking about it, and why I was so angry every time I remembered his birth. And then I found these organizations for birth trauma in Canada and the UK and New Zealand and Australia, and nothing in the US. So I found that in other countries, it's recognized that women can have trauma and PTSD from their birth experiences. And it's great that those organizations exist, but where's the one in the US? And at this point, I was kind of wrapping up my graduate school, and one of the other symptoms of PTSD is obsessive and obtrusive thoughts. And so I started obsessively learning about birth. And in my schooling, I learned about public policy, and I saw how my background of parent education, public policy, advocacy, all kind of could coalesce around this topic of women's transition to motherhood. And what I considered an injustice of women being forced into or out of what they felt was right or wrong for them. And that kind of like sense of justice I got from my father. He would get really, really angry in the face of injustice. And he taught me how to deal with that. And that was always to do something about it, to speak out, to not let it happen, to not look away. And so I found a woman who had started a local birth trauma organization in California. And I took a class from her and I talked to her and she said, I just want to keep it local. I said, but it needs to be national. It needs to be national. And I met another woman on a discussion board who had had a traumatic experience as well. And it both became clear to me that we needed a place for these hurt and broken and distraught women to support each other that wasn't full of horrible triggering birth stories that just triggered all of that anger and frustration and helplessness in situations where they feel like it was beyond their control. So together, I got the three of us together and said, okay, we're going to turn your little local organization into a national organization. And we're going to make a discussion board for women who have had these experiences. And it wasn't so much because I wanted to, be part of creating a nonprofit, is that I knew I needed that for myself. I needed a place where I could go and talk to people who knew where I was coming from, because my friends just thought it was crazy. And I felt crazy and I hated feeling that way. I wanted to get back to normal. And so we ended up creating this discussion board, and this organization turned from Solace into Solace for Mothers. And Solace actually is an acronym that a woman in California came up with, and it stands for Support in Overcoming Labor and Childbearing Experiences. And that discussion board has existed now since 2008, so 3 years, and we have over 1,200 members. And from what we hear, it's been really helpful for women to know that that place exists. We have members from all over the world that we wanted to be, like, we figured we would establish ourselves as the U.S. birth trauma organization, and evidently a discussion board can be accessed by anybody who speaks English anywhere, anytime. So we have members from all over the world now. And I feel like I've done something to help, to make a difference, at least in that area, even though it's 1-6% of women who experience PTSD after childbirth, but it can be up to 33-34% of women who experience some kind of traumatic event that leads to trauma symptoms after birth. And when I realized just how pervasive it was, and I realized I could do something about it, I did. Because I could. And I didn't have a job, and I could do it while I was holding a baby. And it just gave me that outlet that really helped me feel like a full, rounded, complete individual, and not just a mom and not just a breast milk receptacle. So that is how I kind of transitioned into advocacy. It was like, all of a sudden I had this experience of almost success, that I experienced injustice in my world and I was upset about it and I did something about it and it was helpful for other people. And so then I kind of looked around and I'm like, what else can I do that with? I had forgotten that I had wanted to make the world a better place before I wanted to become a minister. That kind of like took over. That's one of the great things about Unitarians, is that they have a very strong focus on social justice, and they do a great deal of work in making sure that each person knows that they have a responsibility to do something good with their lives. And so that's why I was never interested in making a lot of money, because in any kind of nonprofit advocacy work, you never are going to make a lot of money. And it was always, I want my life to be dedicated to something important and big. I just had this view of life as, I don't know, cosmically important and sacred. And I couldn't live it without taking it very seriously and recognizing it for how short it really was and trying to undo some of the wrong that has developed over the centuries. And I had my first little taste of success with that. And it turns out that birth issues are not just focused on trauma, that it's a whole big aspect. It ties into the feminist of, it really made me angry to learn the history of the transition from hospital birth or from home birth to hospital birth, that most people will argue the case that, well, the reason why everybody moved into hospital birth is because home birth was so dangerous. So many people were dying that hospital birth finally made birth safe. Yeah. And like, you know, cause here, once again, men came along and saved the day. Yay. Cause you know, us women, we need that. But really, so this is one of those things, like, I really wanted to understand this, you know, what was so wrong with home birth? Like, how did, you know, a divine creation and evolution screw up so bad that we needed men to save us? And so I just wanted to understand this. And so I looked and read what I could. And it really came down to, from how I understand it, is that emergency obstetric care has been an amazing asset to human survival as it's developed over the last 100 years, but it's gotten to a point where it's overused. And as it's been overused, it sometimes messes up a process that didn't need anything. And when things were really going wrong at home, it was usually that there was no access to emergency care, or that the people who were attending births were not adequately trained in how to deal with those complications. And then you also had poor nutrition and poor sanitation. And even we see in Africa today that most of the infant mortality and maternal mortality deaths that can be prevented are because of nutrition, access to emergency services, and sanitation. And so it really isn't that men came along to save the day, is that we got better at taking care of each other and ourselves, and knowing when to use human ingenuity in appropriate times and situations. So I was shocked to learn that the home birth, or the research on home birth, basically says that with the trained birth attendant, safety of home birth is as safe or safer than hospital birth. And that as safer doesn't refer to mortality, it doesn't refer to mortality, it refers to morbidity, like infection, hemorrhage, hysterectomy, episiotomy, C-section, you know, all of those things where there's physical harm caused to the mother or the baby. That the hospital is really good at preventing deaths, although the deaths still happen at the same number, like the same rate as at home. But the way they go about it actually hurts women and their babies more. You have more NICU admissions, you have more complications from surgery, more complications from anesthesia, all of these things. And I realized that, like, oh, okay, so my desire to trust in my body and believe that my body was created by God, and that evolution, however it fits into the creation, that it works, the best way to let it work without having any of those unnecessary things added into it would be to give birth at home. And so my next baby was born at home. And I'm pregnant again with my third. And this time, not only will this baby be born at home, my mother will be here since she lives with us now. And that will be an interesting experience for her, because I was a C-section, a medically unindicated C-section. And my brother was stillborn, so she doesn't know a normal birth with a living child. So she'll be right there for the action for this one.
Okay, so you went through your birth experience and kind of transitioned into being an activist and working for nonprofit and finding your voice as an advocate for women. So what were the other changes that were happening in your life? How were things going spiritually for you?
My wall that I had experienced with being bored of the church, it burst open when a neighbor introduced me to Fair, which led me to Dialogue and to Sunstone. It was like a huge hallelujah moment when I found the Yoga of Christ. Oh, and what else? Kevin Barney's How to Worship Heavenly Mother Without Getting Excommunicated. I found Mormons that really embraced that concept of truth wherever it can be found. We believe all things. We hope all things. If it is good, praiseworthy. Like, I was so excited. I went from feeling like I had nothing to read to having way too much, having 40 years of Dialogue to catch up with. Oh, I was so sad to live in the war that I lived in, because it was like a clash of cultures. I lived in the same ward with people who were published in Sunstone and Dialogue and who have books on the Signature Library website. Like, I didn't even know this. I had no idea, because they felt silenced in our ward. They couldn't express their experiences of Mormonism openly because it was a student family ward. So we had the natives and we had the transplants, and all of the transplants were like Utah corridor folks that were like super straight laced. And so here, like, I was kind of in between this and not really knowing where I fit and really feeling uncomfortable in my ward for a number of years because of it. And it was since leaving that ward and really exploring this I call it the Mormon underground, that I realized just how much I was missing from open dialogue in the church. And so it kind of became my mission in my new ward to be that alternative voice. You know, I may not even feel the need to bring up a minority view or the alternative view in church, but I now kind of feel a responsibility to do it, because I know how long I went not finding anybody else like me. And so I want to kind of put myself out there as, it's okay to be different. It's okay to think differently. And it's okay to not just read your scriptures, but like find scriptural principles in other places. So yeah, I loved finding the underground. I loved finding Sunstone. It was a very, very happy time for me. I think my first place I went was Women in Authority, because I wanted to learn more about Heavenly Mother. And part of my religious education and like my personal quest before I joined the church was the last thing I actually investigated before learning about Mormonism was Wicca. And I really, really loved the concept of goddess worship. That was another thing that really attracted me to the LDS church, is that, oh, we believe in Heavenly Mother too. I'm like, awesome, because I really didn't like Wicca because they marginalized the male deity. And I felt like it was a reaction to the dominant patriarchal male deity of Christianity to like reject him and keep him quiet and small and not a focus, and instead raise up the goddess. And I didn't want that imbalance. I didn't want that oppression of one gender, or that favoritism over one gender over another. I wanted equality. I wanted to see, you know, a man and a woman ruling together as deity. And that promise, that hope, that concept is there in Mormonism. And after a while, it was no longer acceptable to me to just know about Heavenly Mother's existence. I wanted to know of her. And finding the underground and all of the people who have shared that same feeling for years and years, and who have been writing about it and trying to develop a theology of Heavenly Mother, really helped me feel like I could feel free to explore that and to find her. And so it got me back into paganism, and I was like, hey, you know, I've always had this interest in world religions. I can be Mormon and I can study religion. And I've met since then a number of Mormons who that's what they did in college. That's their career, is that there are Mormons with doctorates of divinity. And I wish that I had known them earlier. I wish I had had experience with, at a personal level, these more alternative Mormons. But, you know, better late than never. I'm glad that I finally found them, and I don't regret where my life has taken me and what I've done and what my experiences have been. But there's a part of me that wishes that I had found them sooner.
Give us kind of a portrait of what you were becoming at this point. because you gave us a good understanding of Jenny, the Universalist Unitarian, and then Jenny, the just trying to soak stuff up and not judge and conform on the surface and think my own thoughts underneath the surface kind of a thing. And then Jenny, the advocate. So who is this Jenny now? What's the spiritual identity? Like, can you give us some view of who you were becoming?
Where I am now. And I'm glad you say where I am, like who I am becoming, because I'm still really young. I have, you know, I'm at the beginning of my life now. And I'm so happy to be able to say that, because I know from the perspective of a Mormon woman, it can often feel like our lives are over when we have our first child, that like we cease to exist being who we were before then, and that our entire concept and identity is wrapped up in wife and mother. And I'm really happy that I don't feel that way, and that I have found these avenues of thought and these communities where I can value myself as a whole person and where my family values me as a whole person. Just last week, I spent 4 days away from my babies and at a doula training to become a doula. At this point in time, my spirituality centers on service, on seeing how applying the gospel principles can make the world a better place. That I see, I kind of have felt a calling, the spirit guiding me to be present for women during birth and to recognize it as a sacred time, and to kind of, I hate to say it this way, but to kind of protect that space for a woman to find that inner strength that will serve her as a mother and help her to navigate this just life of a feeling like you must conform and you must be a certain way, but you can really find your own path as a woman. Oh, one of the talks that just really upset me when I saw it for what it was one of President Hinckley's talks on, I think it was like To the Women or something, where he basically described the identity of a Mormon woman is wife, mother, and Relief Society sister, period. Nothing more. Although he had, in a separate talk elsewhere, said that the whole gamut of human experience is now open to women. It's like, you're telling me this, but I don't believe you, because you're telling me that I should be a wife and a mother and a Relief Society sister, and there's no encouragement to be anything more. And that took a lot of soul searching of, you know, what do I really believe? And what feels right for me? What is the spirit telling me? And can I follow the spirit when I feel like it's telling me something different than the prophet or an apostle? And I know that's this really sticky situation for a lot of people. And those are things that I've just in the last year really had to come to terms with. But since I've found it, and since I've realized that the service that I feel drawn to give does not have avenues in the church to provide that service, that I don't have to wait for the church to change, and I really don't even have to try to get the church to change, and that I can just do what feels right to me and provide the service and find how to do that without going through church channels. And so I feel becoming a midwife and becoming a doula, both things that I'm working on at this point, are ways that I can build the kingdom. I can, you know, work towards Zion by being that type of community that women have lost over the generations, and really just tapping into that primal, natural, what I feel is, oh, how do I explain that? This belief that nature and people, as they follow their instincts, they shape their community to work in a way that sustains them evolutionarily. And I believe that women supporting women in childbirth was where we were heading, and it was working, and what we needed, and that's where we're still heading, and what we need to do in order to help that reality be possible and to have as low maternal rates and morbidity rates as possible is to help technology find the balance of when it's appropriately being used and when it's not. And that really can only come from women deciding for themselves what's right for them based on what they feel inside their body and what they're willing to accept for themselves. And I feel like as people in general are able to decide for themselves what's right for them, taking under advisement, you know, the voice of experts and knowledgeable and wise people around us, that we will be empowered as the human race and be able to overcome whatever wrongs have existed and been perpetuated over the centuries. Because I see that connection, it goes from birth to global really quickly when you say it that way, that I care deeply about the inequalities that exist between the rich and the poor and the developing world and the developed world. And it's just unconscionable to me that there are people with way, way, way more than they can ever use and people who are starving. And I see that there are ways to work together as humans in communities to have the will to fix these things that are so wrong in the world. And I know that there are a lot of people, and that I have fought this belief and wanting to sink into that belief that this world is such a terrible place and there's no way it can be saved. And how could a God let these things happen? It's a really tempting mindset to embrace when you feel hopeless in the face of just terrible things happening and continuing to happen. And there's nobody stopping them, and the people who could stop it won't. It can be really upsetting to recognize that you live in that world. And my thing is that we can address those things. We can work together, and that the solutions have to be there. And it comes down to now, do we have the time to make it right? I don't know if Jesus is coming. I kind of hope that the scripture, by grace we are saved after all we can do. I hope that the second coming uses that and that it's only after we have done everything we can do to make this world a better place, and that there's some things like death that we can't overcome on our own, that's when Christ will come and make everything better. But climate change, what happens if our world is naturally destroyed before we can fix some of these things that need to be fixed, where people are actually free, where people have food security, where there's not oppression and war and all of these things that make people not want to believe in God, and that are humans doing things to other humans that are just so wrong. That's kind of where my spirituality has taken me right now, is finding practical, actionable things that we can do to help. That's outside of myself, and that I can't just do on my own. I can't go tell everybody that we should all just work together to make sure that people in Africa have what they need. But that's kind of where I feel like I cannot, again, in my life, neglect that for the spiritual inner experience of the divine. And it took me a number of years to get to that point where I had that divine inner relationship. And once I feel secure in that, I feel stable and safe, I have my foundation there, that I now have to look outside of me. But I also recognize how overwhelming looking outside of yourself all the time can be. That one of the things I have to really work on is overcoming discouragement. And that's when I have to reconnect to the inner. And I do that through prayer. I do that through scriptures, but I also do that through learning, through continuing that search for truth and meaning. And if it's in yoga, if it's in the pagan, if it's the high, wherever I can find it, I will embrace it and I will integrate it into my path and recognize that truth is truth. And I'm grateful for it. So that's where I am now.
So you wrote to me that you identify as a universalist pagan Mormon.
Yep.
Which, like, it makes me smile just thinking of the combination there. Can you give us a story or two that shows how those three weave together? It seems a little bit like mixing oil and water in some ways.
You know, oh, so Yo Gabba Gabba taught me this one. Do you know what happens when you mix oil and water? You get rainbows. So you get rainbows.
Okay, interesting way to think of it.
It was the story on Yo Gabba Gabba that there was the oil people and the water people, and they could never mix with one another. It wasn't the children were taught to never ever play with the other substance. It just was not safe. There was something very wrong with it. And one day, a couple of children decided to ignore that and see what happens. And what happened is that they mixed, and you got that sheen of oil on water. And so they're like, hey, we can make rainbows. And all of a sudden their world became much prettier, and they had community because they were connected to one another. And that's kind of how I see the world, is that we can have some truly beautiful things when we let down our preconceived prejudices about stuff. When it comes to the universalist Mormon, it got to a point where when I moved to Seattle. And I realized that my culture was going to be very different than the Mormon culture, that, you know, my husband and I were going to be equal partners, and that I was going to maybe not work for pay. I haven't worked for pay since my son was born, but that I was going to still be actively involved in something outside of motherhood, and that I was going to be home birther, baby wearing, breastfeeder in public, uncovered. When I realized I was going to be those things, I realized that I don't feel at home among Mormons anymore. Really, I want to go back and be with the Unitarians. And I haven't, well, okay, I tried, I thought about it, and I ended up having an experience where I remembered some of my experiences leaving my home church in California, that my minister saying, Mormon, really? Like, are you sure you're going to feel welcome here? And then not really feeling welcome in my congregation. So I emailed a reverend of a local congregation to me here in Seattle, and I said, okay, so I'm Mormon, and I'm Unitarian, and I'm making sense of this for myself because I don't know any other Unitarian Mormons. But I can't let go of that past. There's too many things that connect them and that are true within each. And I love the culture. I love the individual freedom that Unitarians feel to be barefoot and not shave and whatever that they feel and do, to paint their cars purple with rainbows, that I wanted to go back to them. And I emailed this minister and said, okay, I'm Mormon, and I want to be a part of your congregation. Will I feel welcome there? And the answer I guess I was expecting to get back is, of course, we're a welcoming congregation. We welcome everyone. But instead what I got was, don't ask, don't tell. Don't tell people you're Mormon and you're welcome. Oh, really? I was like, that doesn't feel very welcoming to me. Like, I now understand what the gays feel in the military. And that I just could not, I haven't yet, I guess, gotten over that and said I'm going to go. But I have found my comfortable place at the Center for Spiritual Living when I can't take correlation anymore, and when I feel like we need to actually be a little more personal, or that we need to focus more on love or compassion. I go there, because that's where I get the balanced out of the, oh, I don't even know how to describe your typical Mormon sacrament meeting. Or when the hymns get too boring. They just get too dull. I know I can go to the Center for Spiritual Living and get electric violin. It's awesome. And then with the pagan, Jenny B and I actually just had a great experience together, where we celebrated the pagan holiday of Lammas, and we did a feast at our parents' home, and we thrashed grain to where we could say that, because that's what the harvest is. And it was just really kind of a neat experience to observe the life cycles of the earth. And that's where my pagan comes in, is that I get that connection to Heavenly Mother, that she's recognized as a goddess, capable, equal, powerful, that she is a full person. She's not this quiet in the background, sometimes even closeted, which I'm so glad to know that there is that BYU Studies article out there that has, it was like 600 quotes from general authorities testifying of Heavenly Mother and who she is. It's like, let's bring that out. Let's emphasize that a bit. I also recognize that that's probably not in the best interest of church PR, but it would feel really good for me.
Feel good for all the women.
Maybe. You know, except for those women who tend to, I don't know, throw other women under the bus.
Well, no, I think even they, if it was the approved church leaders saying, this is the divinity of womanhood and there is a divine mother in heaven and this is who and what and how, I think they would hold on to it, don't you?
I can hope. I've experienced enough of the mommy wars, or to be a little more pragmatic than that, I guess. Yeah, I would love that. A day when we can testify of Heavenly Mother openly and be taught of her. And that recently what's really been bugging me is, and I recognize this is culture and this is a product probably of Mormons just trying to fit into a society where they're very different, is I just feel like I'm getting beaten over the head with the male pronoun of him and he and father and Jesus. And it's like every time we say Lord, we can include lady. Every time we say God, we can include goddess. Every time we say he, we can see that, we can say them. And it gets a little tiring of doing that for yourself and just wishing that there was content that recognized both. And that's why I love Heather, and I love that she's doing With Your Mutual Approbation. That's just a tiny taste, but listening to conference and even reading Mormon.org profiles, just with how heavy it is on the male pronoun, I just get tired of it.
So the paganism offers you some balance there?
Yes, definitely. And it also, it gets my scientific side. I feel like, well, this ties into another aspect of my struggles over the years, is that after my, well, and it wasn't just my father and my grandmother, it was my other grandmother and my other grandfather and my aunt, all within like a 7-year period, who died. I felt like almost all of my family was on the other side. It's like of my family that I grew up with, I have my mother and me, and my grandfather left. So there's three of us. The rest of my family is dead, and it's very lonely sometimes. That I almost feel like bringing children into this world is a way of repopulating my family so I don't feel so alone. And it's a good thing. They're very interesting people. I love my children, but all people are. And so what ended up happening is that after I joined the church and having that glorious vision of the afterlife provided by what dreams may come, I got to a point where I was like, I have to wait how long before I die? If I'm 20 now, like 60 years. Seriously, I'm going to be waiting 60 years. What am I going to do in that time? Especially when I believed that Mormon women were mothers and wives and Relief Society sisters. I was like, 60 years, really? I was like, I needed more. I needed something to ground me here. And I thought that getting married would do that. And it didn't. And my husband was really confused. Like, why are you still wishing for the afterlife? Like, you have me. Aren't I enough? And I'm sorry. No, I don't know why, but you're not. But my son being born gave that to me, especially as I looked around and I saw how I could help the world and how I wanted that world to be better for my children. And I wanted to teach them the ideals, but also help them recognize that things aren't ideal. And we have the capability of doing something about it and getting and reaching closer for that ideal. It took me years, really years, to feel connected to this life. And it was actually exacerbated by the Mormon belief. Like in college, I threw myself into family history and I would fantasize about meeting my ancestors. I have some cool people in my family tree. One of my favorite names is Wait a While, Make Peace. They were Quakers and I want to meet them. I want to meet my my great-great-grandfather, like add like 63 to that or something, Laurent de Normandie, who was best friends with John Calvin. I want to meet them. I want to talk to my ancestors who started a church, like they founded a church in California. I want to meet my great-grandmother, who was a sergeant in the Salvation Army. I see where I get some of my tendencies from, and I want to talk to them about it. I want to see what it was like being them. I'm convinced that there is a midwife somewhere in my family tree and that somehow her values got passed on to me. And I'm pretty sure she was labeled as a witch. I know that just by looking at human history, that many people who lived in Northern Europe before Christianity got there were pagans. And so I feel like learning about celebrating the wheels of the year and when they worshiped what was around them, and what was around them was the earth and the sun and the moon. And they attributed these marvelous works to a divine being. And the way they observed that worship was through interacting with life. I want to know them. I want to know what it was like to be them, because I feel like I need that connection to earth. That was my answer. My pagan ancestors, who I will someday meet, are telling me to connect to this earth, to find the beauty and the joy in this earth. And this is where the Desiderata becomes really, really meaningful. And to me, the last stanza are, in spite of all the drudgery and I had it memorized. The world is still a beautiful place. Be cheerful, strive to be happy. And there was a point where I could not accept that. I was like, this world isn't. It's awful. It's terrible. I hate being here. I don't want to be here anymore. Really, please, world, stop. Can I get off? And all of those scriptures about be cheerful in the face of affliction, it just didn't make sense to me. And when I was finally able to get to that point where I could say, this world is a beautiful place and you can find joy in it, it was huge. And it came through the experience of giving birth and mothering. And it came through connecting with the earth through observing natural processes. And that's why my blog name is Descent into Motherhood, Connecting with Earth Through Birth, is that it's really like what my journey has been. So those are the stories for Unitarian and pagan, how they relate. Oh, no, I'm going to share one more thing. A success of, or a happy point of my life in the church so far was seeing how this last couple of years of growth and seeking and really just not caring anymore about what people were thinking of me and just doing what felt right to me. My mother finally felt like she saw the vision of the gospel that would let her join the church. And I basically had given up. It had been 10 years since I was baptized. Actually, I'm celebrating 10 years next month. But I basically thought I ended up seeing the church for what it really is and seeing how I could see how she wouldn't want to join it. But when she saw it from the underground perspective, from this really universalist, open, embracing view of things, she decided to be baptized. And I was more surprised than anybody else because I knew what her objections were and I knew where she was uncomfortable. And I remember standing in the ceiling room of the Sacramento Temple during the open house with my mother. And that was back in 2006, I think. And holding her and wishing that I could be sealed to my mother and my father, but realizing that she probably was not going to do that. And I saw valid reasons for why she wouldn't feel comfortable doing it. But then to have her be baptized this last April, that hope of being in the sealing room with her again was rekindled. So now, our next year, knock on wood, and depending on local leaders, she's going to be getting ready to go to the temple and to receive her endowment and to face what's there. But then also the crowning moment of that will be to be sealed to me and my father. And that, although I believe it only to be a symbol, it's still very, very meaningful to have that opportunity to really be blessed that my mother's still here, because of all the people who have died in my life, she was the one who was most sick the entire time. And I'm really glad that I have her here with me and that I can share the gospel with her now, and that she can help me do stuff like this by babysitting. I've spent years with her living 1,000 miles away, and I love my mom. And I love that we're so close to that. The only thing that really kind of weirds me out about that whole ceiling thing is that my husband's going to be proxy for my father. And so my husband's going to be, if I know by proxy, sealed to my mother, but he's my husband. and then I'm going to be sealed to my husband as his daughter.
That is a very strange image. You're right. That is, yes, disturbing.
and so he's like, I don't have to be there. I'm like, but I wouldn't want anybody else. I'll get over it. I promise. But yeah, that's where I'm at right now. I'm at a happy place. Maybe not the most secure place, but a happy place.
This is such an amazing story. It's like watching an amazing tapestry being woven. There's so many different pieces like that are totally unexpected.
I hope there's lots of purple and lots of rainbows in that tapestry.
Yes.
And some trees, lots of trees.
So this tapestry that you've woven, when I look at it, I don't see like the cover of the ensign.
No, you do see one cover of the ensign, and that was, I don't remember what month. It was a few years ago. It was the Tree of Life, and it looked like stained glass.
Oh, you know, I think I do remember that
one. Yeah, and I wanted to hug that ensign because I felt like my spirituality was reflected in that cover. It's this whole connection to Mother in Heaven, but also to that epic journey towards the Tree of Life, towards knowledge, towards joy, that the Tree of Life really has become a symbol for me of what I value, of what's most sacred to me in my life. It's where I want to go. It's what I'm trying to do. And it's how every step of the way that is my focus is towards that tree and the fruit of that tree. And I believe that that fruit of that tree is me being held in the arms of my mother and father in heaven.
Hmm. That's wonderful. So let me rephrase then. I don't see a typical enzyme cover. Instead, I see something that's very dynamic and vibrant and changing instead of something that is carefully contained and projecting a certain image and conforming to a certain ideal. So I guess what I'm wondering is, how do you see yourself and how do you see the church? And then kind of the piggyback question off of that is, why do you stay with the church? What is it that holds you there? Because you seem to have spread your arms wide, and yet there's this very specific institution that doesn't want your arms spread quite that wide.
That's obviously something that I just don't want to let go of. So I see the church doing the best that it can with a really large group of people. And I see that the church is really attempting to appeal to as many people as possible, and that the main demographic they're appealing to is conservative evangelicals who probably think I'm a complete heretic. And I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to get as many people to join the church as possible. And there's maybe working on specific demographics one at a time. I don't know. These are just thoughts that I've had about what is the church really doing right now. And I see that it's still that transition from being marginalized and oppressed and run out of their own country and then being embraced again by that country, but with certain stipulations, that they are still trying to figure out how they fit into the American culture and Western religion in general. And it's not an easy process to figure that out. And I also think that they're very like results and evidence-based organization, that they really like to focus on what works. And so if they see that appealing to mainstream Christianity is effective, that they're going to do that. I hope that someday, and I don't know if it can happen simultaneously, but that they will see how the church appeals universally to various demographics and find the keys that will attract other religious groups. That I think that if the church were to go with more of their less conservative values, like the equal partnership concept and the Heavenly Mother equal to Heavenly Father, that they could appeal to a wide range of, well, so the way to convert the Unitarians, and I apologize to any Unitarians who don't want to hear this, I truly believe that the way to convert the Unitarians is to preach about an equal Heavenly Mother and Heavenly Father, and then preach equal partnership in marriage and compassion and social justice. Those are all components of the Mormon gospel. We believe strongly in them and we work towards them. And maybe, but they're also not the focus. They're not where really the institutional church is paying the most attention to right now. And I think that if we were to use their language, meet them where they are as secular humanists or liberals or atheists, that we really could appeal to a great many people. And we could maybe see baptisms. I know that the church was not soliciting me to join it. If I had been solicited the way they do the soliciting, I probably wouldn't have joined it. It was something that I found for myself. And I think that that's kind of where people like me end up going, is that they either can't see through the culture, which there are times when, you know, like I said, I have to take breaks. I have to step away and go to where I feel fed in that way, because I just don't get it from the Mormon church. But I think that if we focused on more of those kind of universalist values that are inherent in Mormonism, I think that we would step away from the current rhetoric of the church and probably appeal to more people. And I honestly wonder, you know, how really do we want to appeal to conservative Christians, because they already don't like us. I don't know. That's not well stated, but I feel like we are courting a vote that is not going to work. And I would really love to see the more open-minded, welcoming, basic principles of the gospel more promoted. And the reason why I stay is because I see the potential for that. I think it could happen, and I think that it might happen, probably not in my lifetime, but I know that I can be part of that. And I stay because I found organizations and communities where I can connect to people who share these similar ideas. My new favorite, I'm going to give a shout out, is Mormon Democrats on Facebook. And I'll be honest, I don't actually identify as a Democrat. Oops. But I find that my values are promoted there. They're shared there. And so I feel more comfortable there talking about social justice, humanitarian, compassionate service with that group than I do pretty much anywhere else among mainstream Mormons. The Mormon Stories podcast community has been really wonderful for me in finding that community that I felt like I was missing for so long. And so I see that I'm not alone and I can make it work being a part of these groups. And the other reason why I stay is because I cannot find any other religion in this world that shares some of the core doctrines that I feel like I will never be able to let go of. I know of no other religion, and I'm happy to be proven wrong and somebody can educate me, and that's just fine. But I know of no other religion that believes that all people have the opportunity to be saved through eternity, that this life isn't the end, and that judgment doesn't just stop based on whatever happened in this life, that there are chances for redemption and salvation, for repentance and for learning and growth that occur in the afterlife. It's that sort of thing that I cannot let go of. I know friends who have left the Mormon church and who have found other churches, but a lot of times I say, you know, they will tell me, but they just don't believe this. And if they believed this, I would feel happier there. And so it's not that I disagree with the beliefs of the LDS church, except on gays and women. but even there, the doctrine's still there. Like, it's one of those things, like, we know we're supposed to love others, and we know we're supposed to not judge them, and we know we're not supposed to control them. And that's kind of what's in common between homosexuals and women, is that they don't want to be judged, they don't want to be controlled, and we know that we're just supposed to love them, and they're free to make their own decisions. So that is core doctrine existing currently in the Mormon church. Our culture is what gets in the way of that. And so I believe that the truth is there, and I believe that the most complete truth that I have been able to find on this earth is encompassed as a whole in Mormon doctrine. And so I feel like I can't leave those beliefs behind, or I would be giving up something that I know to be true. And even though I see other people doing it better elsewhere, that's true, I do, I know that if I let go, I would be compromising something to go and join them. So I can't, I won't leave. I've said that they'll have to kick me out first. So I'll stay as long as I'm welcome.
I'm guessing you'll even stay if you're not welcome. Is that where you're at?
Yeah, I have said that. I've thought about how far I would rock the boat. And there's a little part of me that they could excommunicate me, and I would still go to church. I still go to sacrament, and I would still take the sacrament, and they would have to find very passive aggressive ways to stop me from taking the sacrament. So yeah, pretty much.
I'm starting to see where your daughter gets her determinedness from.
Oh yeah. You should tell them about how our interview got started.
Well, we waited for close to an hour trying to get this interview started because Jenny's little daughter, 2-year-old Belle, was determined that
she could kick and scream and cry enough to get me to not do this interview, and that she didn't need to play with grandma during that time.
Yeah.
And so that's where we get her nickname, Cute But Determined.
And I'm sensing the same core determination in you as you've told me this story of especially the incredible heartache and journey through grief and multiple deaths and finding a way to ground yourself in this world and find joy and purpose and meaning. you have a determined soul, and it was a wonderful story to hear.
Well, thank you for having me to share it. And thank you for my mother for putting up with cute but determined.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. I invite you to respond at daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com. Thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the music.